You stay away from me and your son. As far as you're concerned, we don't exist.
All right, welcome back to the Cephala Podcast, where we are discussing the HBO show Watchmen. I am your host, Scott.
And I'm Jason.
Today, we are discussing Watchmen Season 1, Episode 6, which is entitled The Extraordinary Building.
Bean.
So, what's that?
Isn't it Extraordinary Bean?
Oh, did I like copy and paste it?
Building?
I don't know.
Yeah.
The one thing I want to cover before we get too far. Oh, you're right. It is The Extraordinary Bean. What was I doing? One thing I want to cover real quick before we start is last week we were discussing that the pills are called Nostalgia, and I went back and did some investigation on the original comic, and in the old comic, Veidt had a line of cosmetics, specifically perfume, that was called Nostalgia. So it was, you know, very throwaway, like in the background, and it didn't have any bearing on the plot, but there were posters for Nostalgia by Veidt. And so this was a sort of an expansion on that in this series. Clearly they are pills, but it is very much taking a beat from the original story. If I remember, I'll try and post the picture as part of the image for this podcast. Do you have anything else before we dive into the first episode or the first scene?
No.
Episode opens with a police interview, and they are interviewing Hooded Justice, and they are like really giving him the full court press. He's in a, you know, kind of like an interrogation room. There's two cops and Hooded Justice, and they really want him to take off his mask because they don't know who he is. That was always the, you know, sort of the mystery in the original comic, was who was Hooded Justice. Hooded Justice was part of the original Minutemen, which we see in this episode, so like the Minutemen from the 40s. So, you know, well before the original comic took place. But his identity was always kind of secret. So that's sort of what this is a nod to, is that they really want to figure out who this character is. So these police are interrogating him, trying to figure out, get him to take his mask off so they can figure out who he is. They basically tell him that they're going to blackmail him because his boyfriend has some, I should say, gay sexcapades on tape in his, what did they say, closet? I forget. Anyway, they want to, they're blackmailing Captain, or I'm sorry, Hooded Justice to go get this film so that they can, you know, expose Captain Metropolis. He basically, Hooded Justice does take his mask off, and it is a reveal that it's a, you know, a white guy, which is what everybody expects. And, you know, just as the cops start to relax a little bit, he basically jumps across the table and beats the crap out of them. I mean, it's very violent, like almost a Tarantino-esque scene of Hooded Justice just beating the crap out of these two cops. And as the scene starts to wrap up, we see it pull back and we realize that it's American Hero Story and not, you know, the real Hooded Justice. So American Hero Story being the, what was the word that PD used? Basically the sensationalized retelling of the Minutemen story that was going on TV. So that's just a little background. Again, you know, where the history of this group, the Minutemen, is important in this universe. And certainly in this episode, because we get the real backstory of Hooded Justice, and it is nothing like what these cops portray. What we see next real quick is we're back at the police precinct in the present day. And Lori walks in and she yells, "Turn that shit off," because they're watching that American Hero Story episode. And again, Lori lived, you know, this. And so this sensationalized retelling, I think, just kind of ticks her off, you know, in sort of the same way it ticks Petey off, that it's just kind of a BS, you know, Hollywood version of the real story. What we see next is that Lori walks over to Sister Knight, and she is in a holding cell, and she is kind of out of it because she has, what, taken that entire bottle of nostalgia pills. She basically explains how the pills work, that they are memories distilled in pill form, and her taking the entire bottle. Number one, you're never supposed to take more than one, and you're definitely not supposed to take somebody else's pills. And so this is going to be bad news, and Lori is telling her that. She mentions that people were taking so many of these pills that they were getting hooked on them, and it caused, you know, a drug problem, I assume, sort of like modern-day fentanyl or heroin or whatever. And ultimately, what she says is that Redford and the FDA outlawed nostalgia altogether. She's trying to get Sister Knight, or Angela, I guess, to sign a consent form because they need to pump her stomach, but they cannot pump her stomach without written consent, which seems kind of weird because if they think, like, the suspect's going to die, they can't, you know, step in, or a doctor can't step in. I don't know. And that's it. And then it cuts to a flashback. Do you want to talk about the flashback? And pretty much the rest of the episode is basically all in black and white, and it's one big flashback as Angela deals with all these memories flooding in from her grandfather.
We've seen it turns black and white. I think the rest of the episode is black and white.
There's a couple, like you said, Schindler's List-esque things where there's a couple things in color, but 90% of everything, 95% of things are in black and white. Yeah.
Oh, well, so it seems to be like there's police officers around. It's like an assembly, and the camera kind of moves around and then comes back to Angela's seat, and we see that it's a black man there. And she's getting his memory and perspective from the past. It looks like all the soldiers are being awarded for something.
Police officers, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, police officers. They're being sworn in as new officers, I think.
This is the 1938 police cadet graduation in New York.
Mm.
So this is her grandfather joining the police force.
Got it. Okay, so there's an older black officer, police officer, maybe a chief or something, who's congratulating all the officers and whispers in Will's ear, "Beware of the Cyclops." Cut to Will and his wife at a club drinking some beers. He says she thinks he joined the army because they hired him for publicity.
Not the army, the police force.
I meant to say enemy, sorry. She says, join the enemy. And she says she's just worried they gave him a gun and stick because he's an angry man. She brings up the fact that her parents were murdered in the Tulsa Massacre. I guess both their parents were, because I guess we find out later that he's the boy that finds the baby girl, which is his wife. So they like knew each other since they were very little, since that moment. We cut again to Will walking outside at night and sees a man throwing a Molotov cocktail into a storefront and yells at him.
Like very blatantly, like out in the middle of everywhere, no mask, just kind of no regard for anything, just casually tosses this Molotov cocktail.
Yeah, the guy just nonchalantly throws the cocktail into the store, breaking the glass, and walks away. Will runs over and arrests him. The man says he didn't do it. He's in the police office now, and he's telling like the clerk there he didn't do it, and he calls Will a spook. Another white officer makes him apologize and says he'll book him, and he makes a hand gesture on his head, like an upside-down okay symbol or something, representing maybe one eye. I mean, this is fairly, like, only moments ago we were cryptically told look out for the Cyclops, so I assume this is obviously connected at this point. Some sort of secret hand symbol, I guess. The clerk seems to change his tone after the Cyclops gesture. Will seems confused. He exits a door in the middle of the street, so it's kind of like dreamlike, all of these sequences cut together really quickly.
Right. Okay. So let's slow down a little bit. Yes, you're absolutely right. So this took me a while to figure out exactly why it felt weird. And like you said, there is mostly truth in what's told here, but a lot of it, again, is memories, and memories aren't 100%. So some things are a little fantastical. So like you said, some of it is dreamlike. A couple things I want to cover real quick. when Will is graduating from the police cadet academy, he's the only black cadet out of, what, I don't know, 20? So that was kind of a big deal. And in fact, when him and June are in the jazz club discussing, Will says, Lieutenant Battle is a Tom, and now I'm a Tom too. They just hired me for the publicity. So even Will is aware, you know, that his position here in this police force, being the only black cop, is mostly for publicity, so that they can say that they're diverse and that they've hired, you know, a black police officer. But as we are quick to learn, you know, they're not really interested in him for his police skills. And the only other thing that I thought was interesting is right after the guy tosses the Molotov cocktail, it's a Jewish delicatessen, so it's worth noting that there's some anti-Semitism going on here. And when Will asks him about, you know, hey, I just, you know, you got to stop what you're doing. I saw you, you know, firebomb that place. The guy's like, no, no, no. He said, they have a rat problem. Maybe one of them chewed through the wires. So he's just blatantly lying to this cop. This white guy, he's very clearly, he's okay firebombing a Jewish delicatessen. He's okay straight up lying to a black cop. He, you know, he's a middle-class white guy in New York in the 30s. You know, he was essentially above the law, especially when it comes to a black cop.
Hmm.
What we see, like you were saying, Will exits the precinct after being frustrated that they took his, you know, his caller away, his perpetrator. And he walks out through, yeah, like you said, kind of like a door in the middle of nowhere. The precinct door is, I guess, floating. You know, it's, again, it's a dream. So he's back out on patrol, and he finds a guy reading Action Comics number one. Do you know what Action Comics number one is?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Superman.
Action Comics number one is the first appearance of Superman, and I had to look it up. It was published in June of 1938. So we get a little reference to the time period here. I guess we already knew from the cadet training because the sign on the wall said New York Police Academy 1938. But so the timelines do jive, and he is reading, you know, about this Superman character who, you know, is brand new. No one knew about him at the time. The guy that's reading the comic basically explains Superman's origin story about how his father realized that, you know, that Krypton was crumbling, and he put him on a spaceship to get him away to safety, which is very much an analog to Will's origin story, where his parents put him on the, I guess that was a wagon, you know, and to get him away, and ultimately, you know, his parents stay behind in the town and they are killed. So just, you know, a little nod to, you know, I guess parallel origin stories. And after he's done talking to this guy about Superman, the arsonist from, I don't even know, what, 10 minutes ago maybe, bumps into him, and Will realizes that, you know, the police officers, they didn't do anything. They just basically let this guy go because it's been such a short amount of time. And Will is really ticked, so he storms back into the precinct, and he's basically saying, you know, you guys were on par to help out, and then all of a sudden this, you know, this arsonist made that okay symbol, that Cyclops symbol on his forehead, and then all of a sudden you let him go. Like, what does this mean? Like, I've been seeing this around. And the desk sergeant basically tells him, I don't know what you're talking about. You need to go home. So basically, you know, to shut him down, like, you're digging too deep. Like, this isn't, you need to stay in your lane kind of thing. And then, so Will, frustrated, realizes that he's not going to get a lot of assistance from his fellow cops. He does decide to walk home, or at least... So he starts walking home, and a squad car pulls up alongside of him and offers him a ride home. And his, you know, some fellow police officers, and they tell him, you know, why don't you get in and we'll buy you a beer or whatever. And it was clearly, you know, an uncomfortable scene. Will wasn't really entertaining it because, you know, after everything he'd seen that day. And I think just, you know, being a black guy in a white neighborhood, he was a little on edge. And they drive off and they say, okay, well, you know, maybe next time. And the cop car with the two police officers drives off. And there were two bodies tied behind the car, you know, like they were dragging corpses or whatever. Mm-hmm. And this is what I was talking a little bit about. I don't think that was real. I think perhaps that was, you know, part of the dream or part of the elaborate, you know, the expanding on this story. So Will's a little freaked out, but he keeps walking, and ultimately the cop car, you know, circles the block and they catch up with him in the alley. Three cops get out of the car and they beat the crap out of him. Like, it's pretty brutal, like 3-on-1.
Okay, so yeah, they start beating him up. They're dragging him out to like a tree with ropes, and they put a noose and a hood on his head and hang him up. It kind of like fades to black, and then he drops, and the officers kind of cut him loose and they say, "Keep his nose out of white folks' business, or the next time they won't let him down."
You let him off the hook pretty easy. It's kind of an intense scene because it's drawn out, and they actually leave him hanging for, I would say, like maybe 10 seconds. So you don't know if like he's actually this is going to be the end. So I thought it was a pretty, you know, intense, emotional scene. Like, are we just going to watch this guy get murdered through his own eyes? But ultimately, yes, you're right. They tell him, just keep out of white folk business, I think is what they say.
Yeah, and we see Angela kind of reacting to this whole situation. I mean, we know that Will doesn't die here, so that wasn't really on my mind, I guess.
But, okay.
But seeing her reaction to it is pretty intense. And then Will is walking home, still with the rope around his neck, and hears a woman screaming in a back alley, and he tears some holes in the hood that he had and puts it back on his head and starts beating up these muggers. I guess they were mugging a couple.
He basically turns like the executioner's hood into, you know, the hood of justice, Matt. He, you know, pokes eye holes in it and then uses it to obscure his identity. And then, just beats the crap out of, I don't know, how many guys was it? Four guys? Four guys were in this alley assaulting this couple, and I don't know how he does it, because he basically just got beat up by those other cops, but he bounces back pretty quick and basically beats the crap out of those four guys.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then he goes home. The next morning, Will's wife like kind of tends to him and says he was in the paper. They were calling him a hero. Like, there's a story of it with, you know, like a masked dude saved a couple, and that it's in the paper, I guess, the next day. She asks why he put the hood back on that night. And then she asks about the movie he watched as a kid. He describes the movie, how the hooded black man is the marshal of Oklahoma, and is the hero that takes down a corrupt sheriff. This was the very first scene in like the whole series, that old black and white, like a silent movie, that we saw. And it's called Trust in the Law. Next, we see she's putting white face makeup on his eyes. And he's not... It says like... Okay, so she says that he's not going to get justice with a badge. He will get justice with this hood. But the townsfolk will need to think he's a white person under the hood. I guess comparing the movie, because all the people were white in the village, the townsfolk... And they, that's what they need, I guess. So as Hooded Justice, he breaks into the a secret Klan meeting.
All right, let's slow down just a little bit. So there were some really cool camera shots here, because Angela is reliving these memories, her grandfather's memories. So most of this is told, you see her grandfather and you see a guy in Will's place. But there are several scenes where the camera switches and you see Angela as the main character. So there's a really cool scene where Will and June are hugging and the camera kind of circles them. And as it goes around June's head, it switches from Will to Angela really quick. I had to watch it like three times just to figure out how they did it. There's a cool scene where Will is sitting down in front of the mirror, and June is putting the white makeup around his eyes. And she holds up a hand mirror, and instead of showing Will's face, you see Angela's face. So there's some really cool camera trickery here to make you realize that that Angela is still involved in this, that this isn't just, you know, a flashback of Will's story. And the only other thing I wanted to note is that Hooded Justice's costume is the reverse of Sister Knight's. So Sister Knight's is a black lady that paints her face or paints her eyes black. And Will is a black guy that paints his eyes white. So there is, I don't even know if that's a familial thing where somehow they both just decided that they were going to paint their eyes. Stylistically, it's cool. Just, you know, it's cool looking. But it's just interesting to note that Will paints his white and Angela paints hers black. You can talk about the next scene. I didn't mean to interrupt. I just thought those were cool points.
Oh, yeah. Well, so he's like out on the prowl with his new get up, and he's sort of monitoring, staking out these corrupt cops, and sees that they are like entering some warehouse. It looks like he like knocks on the door and then breaks in and then starts like basically just beating everyone up. And I think these are all the officers who hanged him, right? In this area?
I don't know if it was really clear. I had to watch it twice to see, like, are these cops? Are they wearing their uniforms while they're, you know, the Klan members? I don't know if they're, I think it's implied that they're definitely part of the police force. If they're the exact ones that hung him, I don't know.
I recognize like the main white dude, I thought, but okay. Yeah, it's hard to say for sure.
But they're basically, there's a warehouse full of Klan members and they're doing something. And, you know, Hooded Justice basically takes them down. I don't know how many there were, five, six. But he takes them down. I mean, he kicks some butt. I did think that it was interesting that even in Will's memory, that it's not an entirely one-sided fight. You know, it's not like Hooded Justice walks in and just destroys everyone and does it flawlessly and doesn't get hurt, doesn't get punched. No, Will actually takes several hits. I mean, ultimately, he, you know, emerges victorious, even though it's 1 versus 5, but he does, you know, get beat up a little bit. And ultimately the fight breaks out into the front of a grocery store. So that was sort of the back behind, you know, the warehouse behind a grocery store. And Hooded Justice ends up jumping out of the window of this grocery store. And I'm pretty sure that was the same grocery store that we saw in the American Hero Story documentary. Remember that one where Hooded Justice jumps in the glass and then beats the crap out of everybody in the grocery store? Remember that?
It had the same kind of feel to it. I mean, right. It looks different. It looks pretty different, obviously, because it's like a TV show, but I think it's evoking that same scenery, yeah.
The main difference was that in American Hero Story, that Hooded Justice arrives on the scene and jumps through the window and starts kicking ass. And at least in Will's memory, the real version was that he came out from the back and realized that he needed to get out of there and jumped out of the front of the window. So he wasn't arriving on the scene to dole out justice. When he got to the grocery store, he had to get the heck out of Dodge. So it was just a slight reverse. But again, I mean, the American Hero Story is a sensationalized tale, you know, made for TV. So I don't expect it to be accurate. We're just getting to see maybe a little bit more of the other side of that.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool idea to see like someone's memories in this way, and then seeing like the societal differences of like the historical accounting of this character who was famous and has like the society's viewpoint of it versus what really happened, you know, so it's supposedly with this nostalgia thing. And it's pretty cool. And then he's jumping out of this window and then it freezes. It's like kind of locked in time. And Angela sees Blake head towards, like kind of walk towards her in this frozen time thing. And she says something like she needs to come home and needs to wake up.
Lori tells her that she's in a coma, that, and they just had to give her adrenaline to restart her heart because clearly it's not a good idea to take that much nostalgia. And she has Cal there with her, and he has a letter that apparently this is part of the treatment for a nostalgia overdose, is that, you know, a close family member has to tell you who you are, you know, and what are the you know, how, what your age is and how many kids you have, that kind of thing, to anchor you into your own reality so that you don't become, or, you know, get confused and think you are this other person. So clearly they have a protocol in this universe for overdosing on nostalgia, which is what they're doing. So Cal has a letter, but he basically says, I'm your husband. We've been married this long. We have three kids. You're a police officer, whatever. So, he, you know, just trying to give her a little, you know, a little anchor.
Yeah. Like, but the president is Robert Redford.
Oh, right.
Like, yeah. Other time period facts.
Right.
And then it like, oh, she also tells her to blink if she's, you know, understanding, and she's able to barely blink, I guess. So they kind of know.
But it's Angela's face underneath the hooded justice mask. So again, it's done another like flip where it was Will under the mask. Now it's Angela under the mask. And like you said, she's blinking to, you know, just basically show that she can understand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it fades to black and we cut to another scene with Will and his wife at their house. A man knocks at the door and asks for Will. He says he's representing a masked adventurer named Captain Metropolis, and he's forming a team called the New Minutemen. And he says Hooded Justice should join him. He says, like, well, first he accuses this police officer of giving information to Hooded Justice because he's been tracking, like, the information and the places that Hooded Justice has been and his... And Will's patrol routes. So he's kind of put two and two together, and he knows that Will is associated with Hooded Justice.
Yeah, it's sort of like this Spider-Man Peter Parker thing. He's like, either you are Spider-Man or you're really good friends with him. Gardner's line is, I believe a cop is feeding him intelligence about a criminal activity. But you know all about this, Officer Reeves, because that cop is you.
Mm-hmm.
And then June implies, so he's implying that in either he is Hooded Justice or he knows him. And June, his wife, has having none of it. She goes, what about your friend Captain Metropolis? Isn't he about your height? You know, blonde dude. You know, she basically throws it right back in his face. She was like, look, dude, we know you're Captain Metropolis. Like, drop the charade. Like, what do you really want? Right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Gardner, after he's sort of cowed by June a little bit, he replies, but I hope you do know Hooded Justice, Officer Reeves, if only to tell him what a huge admirer Captain Metropolis is. So he starts out playing hardball, but then he kind of like softballs it at the end. He was like, well, either way, just let him know that I'm a big fan and I think he's super cool.
Hmm. I didn't even know his name, Gardner.
Yes.
His real name?
His name is Gardner. Yeah, I think when he knocks on the door, he introduces himself and says, hello, I'm Mr. Gardner.
Cool.
After that scene, like, it cuts, like, so they sort of went from, and he excuses himself, Gardner leaves, and that's the end of the scene. So, you know, clearly, or the implication is that June and Will are having some sort of conversation about, you know, am I going to join this guy? I'm going to help, you know, what's going on? You know, here's my chance, right? I could do some real... good. I, you know, I want to go out and investigate Cyclops. I want to do police work that they won't let me do as a cop. Maybe this is my chance. This all happens. Like, I'm implying that this is what happens. Or, and the next scene is like Gardner and Will like having sex, like in what I assume is Gardner's apartment, or because it's pretty nice. And like they finish, and Gardner, it's like putting the full court press on him, like, you know, hey, thanks, the sex was really good. But by the way, you should join the Minutemen. I think it would be really good. But Will is still hesitant. He's worried that, you know, I'm a black guy in a white universe. Like, I don't know if the other people on the, you know, the team, are they going to put up with me? Like, are, you know, clearly you're okay with it, but what about the rest of these guys? And, you know, Gardner tells him, you'll need to be hooded and covered up at all times because not everybody is as open-minded as he is. So I don't know exactly how we went from, hey, maybe you should join my superhero organization to, you know, once you come over to my apartment and we'll have hot gay sex. So yeah. That was a quick jump, but it's not super important. You know, I don't know if maybe that's part of, you know, the memories being, you know, what they are. Because this would have been, I mean, I don't know, how old do you figure Will was in this? Like his mid-20s, and Will in the present day is 102, so this is, you know, 80 years in the past.
Hmm. Yeah.
Will is definitely hesitant to join up, but he does realize that he's going to need the Minutemen's help to take on Cyclops, and that's his goal, because he sees injustice in the police force, he sees injustice around town, and specifically racial injustice, and he thinks that if he has the assistance of the Minutemen, that maybe he can do some good in the universe. And yeah, that's kind of it. So my thought when I was watching this scene is, like, Will has never met Angela until, what, like 3 days ago? And he's got this elaborate plan that he wants Angela to take his nostalgia pills. But part of that is learning about his secret identity that is Hooded Justice, which is, you know, probably fine. But the other part of that is you got to watch your grandpa that you barely knew, like, having hot gay sex. Like, wait a second. Like, that's pretty weird, right?
Yeah, that is weird. If that's what his plan was, I guess.
I don't know. I don't know. I'm just sitting there thinking, like, if I was all of a sudden, like, beamed into my grandparents' head and I was forced to watch this, like, that would be alarming, right? That would be... I got to imagine, like, yeah, just getting all these, you know, memories of your grandparents at all has got to be pretty weird, let alone here's your grandpa banging another guy, but whatever.
The whole thing is very alarming, as you put it, I would say. It all qualifies, him getting nearly hanged. The whole experience.
I'll do the next scene is super quick. We see June and Will in bed, and she asks him to tell the story of how they met. She was the baby in the American flag that young Will finds after the town burns down. So they have apparently known each other since they were kids. And he says that when they met, she was crying. And he says, she says, "Don't you ever make me start again, William Reeves." So I don't know. I mean, he's kind of got this double life, right? He's a cop. He's also like a married man, but he's, you know, he's having gay sex with Captain Metropolis. So it's weird.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing we see a press conference with the Minutemen. So Captain Metropolis has put together the first iteration of the Minutemen. And Hooded Justice is starting to talk about, he wants to talk about Cyclops. And that he wants to get the Minutemen to go out and investigate them. Like, now his chance, now here's his chance sort of to force the Minutemen's hand. He's going to get this on the record. He has like a book, like a scrapbook of things that the Minutemen have, or that about Cyclops. And just as he starts to talk about Cyclops, Captain Metropolis cuts him off. He was like, "Oh, okay, let's talk about something else," because he's not super interested in this Cyclops thing. Captain Metropolis brings up Moloch, who is going to harness the power of the sun. It's just a quick throwaway nod. Moloch is in the original comic. Rorschach actually goes and interviews Moloch to figure out some information about the comedian dying. He's an old-timey bad guy in this universe. He's retired and, you know, kind of decrepit in the comic. So this would have been Moloch, like, in his prime doing bad guy stuff. And apparently what he was trying to do was harness the power of the sun.
Hmm.
And just as the scene is ending, Captain Metropolis reveals a partnership with a bank. And he says, you know, make sure you do all your banking at, you know, First National Bank or whatever. And it's that racist sign that the 7th Cavalry had in their, you know, headquarters of, I forget who it was. Was it Captain Metropolis? Anyway, that he had a black guy down on his knees that he had caught essentially trying to rob this bank. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's, we live in a different era now, but like he's standing there right next to Hooded Justice, who he knows is a black guy. And like, this is clearly like super racist, you know, this poster. And he doesn't really have a problem bringing it up in front of his friend. He was like, "Yep, make sure you go to this bank because, you know, they don't let black people up there," or whatever. I don't know. So we're learning that Captain Metropolis is kind of a dick.
There's the super racist ad for a bank. We kind of fast forward through time, I guess, And we see he has a son. It looks like he's like six or something, I think, who is watching him get ready as Hooded Justice.
But we see a quick flash of June pregnant, and then we see them with a baby, and then we see them with, yeah, like a six-year-old kid. So, you know, it's like three quick scenes back-to-back, just, I assume, just to accelerate the storytelling. Ultimately, what Will is doing is he's building that scrapbook of all the racist attacks that are going on in the world, right? And his kid is right there watching him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's fast-forwarded through time a bit. Then it cuts to, like, another scene of him in his police outfit heading towards, like, a theater, and there's, like, a really chaotic scene out front. Like, there's... the sign seems to be really broken. There's cars wrecked. There's smoke and fire everywhere. And he talks to another officer saying it's, like, the people are animals, and Will should go in because he speaks their language. So
yeah, Will asked the cop standing outside. He says, "Hey, what the heck happened here? Because this building is falling apart and on fire." And the cop says, "Same thing that always happens when you put a bunch of animals in the same cage. Go on in. We need somebody who speaks their language." Before Will walks in, did you happen to notice what they were playing at this theater?
Mm-mm, no.
It's a movie theater, and they were playing The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which I don't know anything about. The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, but it's essentially it's a play about someone with a secret identity or a secret life, which is again completely analogous to exactly what Will is doing. Right, he's a cop by day and he's Hooded Justice by night.
Hmm.
All right. So what happens inside the theater?
Okay, so he goes inside and there's like bodies laying everywhere. It doesn't seem to be like any additional violence happening currently, but there's a woman like crying in one of the seats, and he kind of approaches her. She talks about like a flicker of bright light, and like voices telling her she had to hurt people. She says she heard like voices in her head, and there's a quick flashback to the older black officer saying, "Beware of the Cyclops." And I think it like flashes back to him looking, seeing that book of mesmerism for the masses or something. So it's kind of his memory putting together this idea that the Cyclops group may be like brainwashing or mesmerizing black people. And causing them to do violence, I guess.
Where do we first see that book about mesmerism?
When he first infiltrates that like Ku Klux Klan
place. Oh, right. In that warehouse. Yeah. Okay. So Will interviews the lady that's sitting there. Right. Her name is Lorna.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. And so he's putting those together. He goes outside the theater and sees some dudes like giving the Cyclops hand signals to each other back and forth and loading a car with what looks like projector equipment. And he calls Metropolis on the phone. I'm pretty sure it's Metropolis.
Yeah. He calls Will Gardner Metropolis. Yep.
And tells him about the conspiracy and he's dismissed. Metropolis tells him to just do it on his own. I guess you're gonna have to do it on your own, which is weird. Like he doesn't believe him. But
is it weird, though? I got the impression that, like, Captain Metropolis, I kind of felt like he was just using Hooded Justice. Like, he wanted somebody else for his team. He probably wanted to bang him. I don't know. But, like, clearly, like, even at that press conference, like, he didn't want anything to do with Cyclops. I don't think Captain Metropolis and Hooded Justice are really friends, or it's a one-way street.
Yeah, yeah, I guess I just didn't understand, like, that relationship very well. It seemed like he cared about him, you know. He's accepting of him, but maybe his teammates aren't. I don't know. I guess I didn't totally get that. And I guess the confusing part was that he kept telling him it's not real. It's you know what you're saying is a conspiracy theory. It's probably not true, but also telling him he's gonna have to do all of it on himself, like really emphasizing that. So I don't know, it was just a weird conversation, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So the guy from the beginning who threw the Molotov cocktail, that dude is standing right outside the phone booth conveniently. And right, like, right, this, yeah, what?
Okay, real quick. So yes, you're right. He calls Gardner and basically tells him Cyclops is using some kind of mesmerism to make black people turn on each other. And Gardner's response is, "Dear God, so the Klan is using mind control? Do you have any idea how ridiculous that sounds?" So he shoots him down right away. He doesn't even offer, doesn't even entertain the idea of bringing the Minutemen out to investigate this. Like, there's a flaming movie theater like two blocks away. You know, you would think this would be all over superhero, you know, radar to come out and help people. And he's just like, "Nope, not interested. This just sounds too crazy to me." And I made a note right here, and I said, this is why The Watchmen is good, both the original and this. Because if this were the Avengers, or if this were the Justice League, Batman calls Superman, Flash calls Batman, whatever, they all show up immediately, they all get along, they're all on the same page, they all fight against evil, it's very simple, black versus white, right? But in this, like, the characters are nuanced, right? Like, maybe Captain Metropolis is a secret racist, we don't know. But all we know is that they don't all get along. I mean, clearly the new Minutemen, several of them were not even comfortable having a black guy, so much so that he had to wear his, you know, his outfit the entire time. And when one of their own asks for legitimate help after this you know, assault at this movie theater, they shoot him down. So this is a very different take on, you know, the superheroes, where it's very clear good versus evil. This is muddying that line right there. This is showing that, hey, you know, Captain Metropolis, I think, is the analog to Superman, right? He is the epitome of the good guy.
I know nothing about Captain Metropolis from this episode. Like, this literally had like two scenes with him, so I think there's a lot more to him, his character, I guess.
I don't think so. I don't think it's important. He's in the comic. He's in the comic as a flashback, because the comic takes place in the 80s and this is the 40s. Mm-hmm. So there's not a whole lot to know about Captain Metropolis, except that he's the leader and that he is the Superman, essentially, of this universe. I mean, he is the blonde-haired, blue-eyed, you know, most Americana kind of guy that there is. I think a little bit of that is apparent at the press conference that they had, when the press defer to him over Hooded Justice. Anyway, it's not important. You don't have to really know anything about Captain Metropolis. You just have to know that the new Minutemen that Hooded Justice has joined, they're not all on the same page. They're not a super cohesive team, I think, like you would normally see in the pages of a comic book.
Okay, yeah, that's fair.
And then, yes, back to you can, where he runs into the arsonist from before. Conveniently, like you said, right outside of the phone booth, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess this is a memory, so, we're not... It's all kind of dreamlike, like we said. And he's, like, mocking him and telling him he'll give him free steaks if he goes to his warehouse, something like that. And then this mustache wearing, you know, dude that threw the Molotov cocktail says, "Do I know you?" So he doesn't even know who this police officer is. He's just kind of mocking him as a black officer.
He's just being a dick just to be a dick.
Yeah. Will shoots him in the head pretty
quickly. No hesitation, like, yeah. Full on Han Solo shoots first style, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
He's had a long day. He's had a rough day. He just saw this theater of all his, you know, a bunch of other black people just get burned down or essentially destroyed. And then this guy's breaking his balls and he was just like, "Fuck it." And just shoots the dude straight in the head. It's great.
And he heads into the warehouse, that the Molotov guy says he owns and was going to take him. And he see, like, he's walking past some slaughtered cows hanging. And then some dudes with projectors, and he just starts shooting all of them. He starts gathering some of the evidence.
Again, no hesitation. He just walks into this building, sees cameras. He sees cops. These ones are actually, they're in their police uniforms, right? Before it was, they were in Klan uniforms. So he walks into this warehouse and he sees these cops doing shady stuff with cameras, doesn't hesitate, and just starts shooting.
Yeah. And he's like gathering evidence. Looks like he's still wearing his hood, or he is wearing his hood, but he still has his police uniform on, which is kind of odd. I guess because he was on patrol and he just put the hood on, so we know he didn't like go back home and change. He goes into another room with a man recording what appears to be the worst podcast ever.
he's executed what, like at least 5 people in that first room, right?
Yeah, yeah, and then he
goes about. Into the next room, right? And there's a guy recording a horrible racist podcast, essentially, right?
Yeah, not my kind of podcast, doesn't seem like, but you know, it's a long tale. And he's about to shoot him, and he's out of ammo, so he grabs like a mic cord and like strangles him.
Well, he raises his gun kind of like in this drawn out scene a little bit, and he points it at the guys. He stands there and he listens to what this guy's saying for a while, and he's basically saying horribly racist shit. And he like the gun, you know, comes up and it gets level with his head, and he pulls the trigger and it just clicks. And then, yeah, he just kind of loses it but chokes the guy out with the headphone cord.
Yeah. And so presumably, I guess he's recording like this mesmerism stuff, where it's supposed to hypnotize, because like a lot of what he's saying is like, I don't know, you're a bad black person, you need to hurt other black people.
Black people are your enemy. When you see a black person, like you must hate them. Yeah, right.
So I think it's, that's what they're creating, this like weird mesmeristic content. Mesmeristic? I don't know what the word is, but they're doing some weird stuff. And the next thing is he puts the bodies into a pile and puts some gasoline on them and lights them on fire, including the Molotov cocktail dude.
Yeah, and he burns the whole warehouse down, right? I mean, I think he walks outside and you see he's not just burnt the bodies, he's burnt this entire warehouse.
Yeah, and there's like an image of him standing in front of the burning building, and then it flashes back to him as a little boy outside of the burning of town of Tulsa, which is pretty evocative
for sure. Next we see Will, and he has arrived home at his apartment, and his kid, who again is what, probably 6 or 7 at this point, and he has a noose around on his neck, and he's dressed like Hooded Justice, and like the kid, you know, he wants to emulate his dad. I mean, what 7-year-old doesn't want to be like their dad, right? And Will freaks out. You know, this is not what he wanted to walk home to, probably, especially not on this particular day, right? And the kid yells, "I'm like you." And Will just responds, "No." So, yeah, I think that's what every parent wants, right? You know, like, I don't want you to have to put up with the shit that I have to put up with, right? I'm doing this because I have to. I was forced into this. I want a better life for you. So he basically makes the kid take the makeup and the noose off. And June has a really powerful line here. So she's, you know, protecting the kid because, you know, Will is pretty hot about, you know, everything that's gone on this day. And now his kid wants to essentially go out and be a vigilante. And June says, "You need to hide under that hood because you can't stand to see what you've become. I thought it would help you get rid of this thing you have, but it didn't get rid of it. It just fed." So she was supportive of him being Hooded Justice because originally he was really angry at being a cop and not being able to be an effective police officer because of everything, you know, the racism in the police force. But now that she sees the other side of it, you know, him becoming Hooded Justice was not a good thing. It has spiraled out of control, and she's letting him know to his face, hey, this is not a good thing.
He tells him that he needs to go home to Tulsa, something like that, but then he wasn't talking to him. He was talking to the son, I guess. So that, I guess that just means that they're leaving him, right?
Yeah, I was going to ask, is that what happened? Because I wasn't entirely clear. One of the last lines, we can cut ahead just a little bit, is June talking to Will, and she says, "You are an angry, angry man. You stay away from Tulsa, Will Reeves. You stay away from me and your son. As far as you are concerned, we don't exist." So this, you know, whatever happens, the deterioration of their relationship happens off screen. Ultimately, they, you know, break up and Will goes on his own. But it's not entirely sure, or it's not indicated to us what happened. But clearly it was probably, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back when, you know, Will crossed the line one too many times as Hood of Justice. Or maybe it was getting in his kid's face. Yeah, we don't know. But the point is that June and Will separate.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the scene with Will at the tree?
Sure. Yeah. So we cut after that scene with the family. We cut to old man Will.
We're back in the present day.
Well, sort of. It's still black and white. And we see a rope in his lap. It was like a fade from Hood of Justice in the past holding that costume rope. And then we see old man dude with the rope in his wheelchair. And then we see a truck. So he's on the side of a highway, and we see a truck drive by, and this truck hits some road spikes. So immediately we think of the scene with Judd, or what happened to Judd when he was hung. He first got like stopped by running over some road spikes, and so Will is there, and Judd gets out of his truck, inspecting the road spikes, and Will flashes like this blinking light at him, which allows him to like control him apparently. So he's like flashing at his face behind him while Judd is pushing his wheelchair forward. So he's controlling him and telling him to move him toward this tree. So I assume that this like magical flashlight is utilizing a similar mesmeric technology that the Cyclops dudes were using in those past scenes.
I think that's exactly what it's supposed to evoke, is that somehow Will has grabbed onto this mesmeric technology, which would be insanely dangerous. I mean, can you imagine, like, you just had a flashlight and all you had to do is shine it at somebody and they'll do whatever you want? Like, society would collapse, right?
Yeah, that's quite a new technology. And even when they're talking in the field in front of this tree, he's not even flashing the light at him, but Judd's just kind of standing there and saying, "Hey, why are you doing this?" And they're kind of arguing. I guess Judd tells him, "Hey, I'm trying to help you people." And Will asks him about the clan robe in his closet. So this makes me really question, like, what the heck is going on here? It's not illuminating for me. So he's like hanging Judd because he knows about the hidden clan cloak in his closet. Anyway, they have a conversation about this cloak, and Judd says, "Well, it's my granddad's. He has a right to keep it." And Will asks, "Well, why do you hide it if you're so proud of it?" And Judd says, "You don't know me, old man." And Will says, "Oh, I know you," and uses the Cyclops symbol. And then makes Judd hang himself with the flashlight of amazing power. And then we see Angela's perspective again.
It does like a camera flip where instead of Will sitting in the wheelchair, you know, it cuts back and Angela is now sitting in the wheelchair, right?
Yeah. So we see her perspective of her seeing Judd being hanged, which is, you know, a interesting, powerful moment for her perspective. And she's really great in the scene. Like, she looks like not remorseful, not worried, almost like she really wants this to happen, kind of embodying, I think, Will's emotions in that moment. But it's not what her character may have done. So you wonder how much of her is there and how much she's just kind of how much she's experiencing that moment. It's a good, I really like this end moment, I guess. So after this, we see a bunch of weird flashes of memories kind of blinking in and out. I wasn't really able to catch all of them, but I think it's just meant to say that, like, this nostalgia stuff is kind of coming to an end, and it's starting to loop, and it's starting to, like, kind of go bad.
Working its way out of her system.
You think that's what it is? Okay.
I think that's, I mean, yes. Because, I mean, well, what happens next is we see Angela wake up in a, I don't know, in a different place.
Yeah.
And Lady True is there, just like literally just sitting by her hospital bed. She's in, I guess, what's Lady True's vivarium, maybe? I don't know. And well, Lady True.
Right before that, though, the last memory she sees is an older black woman who I assume is June, kind of talking in the background as she's walking and says, what did she say?
Yeah, that's where she says, "You are an angry, angry man. You stay away from Tulsa, Will Reeves. You stay away from me and your son. As far as you're concerned, we don't exist." That?
No, after that, that's the historical June, that's the younger one. But then there's an older lady, she's much older, and as she's walking up, she says, "Oh, she does look like you." And then says to Angela, "I'm going to take you home now, honey." And that's when she wakes up. So I'm thinking that this nostalgia pill was specifically engineered for this whole effect to take place. Like it contained that memory of older June, I guess, I don't know for sure, but like it's not a normal nostalgia pill. Maybe it's like a specifically one that's meant to affect maybe Angela specifically and like let her wake up. I don't know that, but that end moment of that old lady really, I think, tells you that the memories were engineered in a specific way, I think.
Okay. I didn't pick that up, but I'll have to rewatch the end of it. Interesting. It's worth, you know, noting, I think, like, how absolutely, I mean, like, it makes sense why they would have banned nostalgia. Like, I can't imagine being assaulted with all of these memories. Number one, it's got to be traumatizing just to be exposed to someone else's memories, right? You know, I imagine my brain works a specific way, and all of a sudden you're exposed to raw memories from someone else. It's got to be pretty jarring. And then on top of that, you have just these just horrendous memories of what her grandfather went through, and this, you know, just the trauma that he had to deal with. And, you know, she essentially just gets exposed to this, you know, in one gigantic dose. It's mind-boggling to me, like, that anyone could walk away from this and still be a functioning human, like, and not just be completely blown away and, you know, PTSD or shell-shocked from just being thrown into this horrendous, you know, this negativity, like, all at once.
Well, I think of Star Trek: The Inner Light, honestly. Like,
okay,
do you remember that episode where?
Oh yeah.
Captain Picard happens upon like a relic of some society,
mm-hmm.
and it like captures him, and then suddenly he awakens in this other world with another like family, and then he lives like a whole lifetime's worth of memories, like decades, and then mm-hmm. he dies in this other world with this other family, other life, and then he awakens back into Captain Picard in like just a moment later from when it happened. So he'd lived decades later. Very similar. I really like that. That is a cool concept. Also, the fact that like a pill could ignite certain memories seems like a really legitimate sci-fi concept.
For sure, yeah.
You could fire like specific memory synapses in the brain and like trigger that specific memory over and over. It does seem like it could be very possible, and that's a cool scientific, like sci-fi concept to explore.
I mean, how cool would that be if there was a pill and you could take it and you had, you know, whatever, 20 years experience as, you know, whatever your career is, like you're a web developer, like you take a pill and all of a sudden you have, you know, this, all these memories of having done this for 20 years, and how much more effective are you at your job? Or you want to learn, I don't know, Spanish. You're like, okay, well, I'm just going to take this pill. And it has all these memories of me growing up in Spain, and now I can speak Spanish fully. Yeah, well, absolutely. That's a cool idea.
I'm thinking more of like it's refiring those synapses that were created from your memory, because your brain is a bunch of synapses that, I don't know how neurology works, but I assume like maybe as your brain is formed over time, it's created those synapses and they're kind of like embedded in your brain. And so if you could take something that could fire those memory ones, those specific memory ones over and over, you could relive like a memory over and over. It seems possible to me, but I don't know about making, like, creating other memories and forcing other memories into other people.
Sure.
But
I mean, we are talking science fiction, so I mean, yeah, it would be a lot more complicated. I mean, ultimately, the episode ends. Angela wakes up in a hospital bed at Lady True's. She's sitting there reading a book, and Lady True is totally nonplussed. She just says, "Oh, hi there. Welcome back. Like, no big deal." And we see Angela, you know, she's connected to an IV or whatever, and she kind of looks at Lady True, and she was, you know, a little confused about what's been going on. And that's it. And then the episode ends, and I noted that the closing song is Living in the Past by Witch. So clearly, I mean, this entire episode was just all about Angel reliving her grandfather's memory, so I think that's a pretty apropos closing song. So, yeah, we didn't advance the, you know, the plot of the show itself a whole lot in this episode. This was clearly all backstory to get Angela and Will on the same page. We definitely learned a little bit more about Hooded Justice and, you know, some of the original Minutemen. But as far as advancing the plot of the show, we didn't do a whole lot. Sort of like the last episode where, you know, this is a middle of the season episode, and, you know, we're setting up some plot pieces. We're setting up the dominoes so that when we get towards the end that we will have something to knock over.
Well, and we don't even know why he killed Judd. Like, I was super disappointed in that interaction with him and Judd. I figured they had some sort of history. He knew something specific about Judd, he could reveal something about Judd that we didn't know. But no, it's just, oh, you have a hidden KKK cloak in your closet, I guess. You should be hanged. That was it. Like, we already knew that. That could be reasonable for someone who did have a grandpa that had, and it would be reasonable. Honestly, it would be reasonable to hide something like that, even though it's like a weird memento. Maybe, if you're a reasonable person, you maybe want to get rid of it, but like, it doesn't necessarily mean he's like the mastermind of some racist conspiracy, right? It doesn't tell us that. So
I don't think
that part was very disappointing, I think.
Okay, fair enough. The Will story is clearly not done yet, so there is more to that story. I don't think that Will necessarily owes Judd an explanation. I mean, he's not a Bond villain. He doesn't have to explain why he's killing him, you know. But, you know, story-wise, does it make it better for the audience if he says, "Oh, hey, I'm killing you, and here's the reasons"? Sure. Well,
he asked them about the cloak. Like that matters for some reason. This cloak. So that to me is like really weak as an interaction and motivation for Will. Like, so maybe we'll learn more motivation later. But I really found this episode really powerful. But that last part obviously was underwhelming to me. But or just disappointing, I guess. You know. Yeah.
Do you want to go through your list? Did you cross anything off your list or add anything to your list of questions?
I mean, you know, this was all about Will. So Will's character makes a lot more sense now. So Hooded Justice was a character that I didn't really know much about. We heard in the background. So we now know that Will is Hooded Justice, which is an answer to that question of who Will is and what, you know, what the story is there, maybe, you know, for Will's motivation in like approaching Angela and like giving her these pills. But yeah, there's not much more than
that. I think part of Will's motivation is that he wants to connect with his granddaughter, right? And what better way, I guess, than saying, "Hey, you're a masked vigilante? Well, hey, I was one of the first ones, you know, I was the Jackie Robinson of masked vigilantes. You know, I had to keep my identity secret. Everybody hated me. Like, you live in a world where, you know, you can be a black cop that goes out and beats people up and that's okay. You know? So, you know, maybe that's his weird way of saying we're not so different. Right. Okay, you know, so like
it's his weird way of doing this, but this would not be my first instinct of his motivation to want to connect with his granddaughter. Like, he could just kind of reach out, like actually tell her these things rather than like,
sure,
mysteriously leave these pills behind and like,
right,
takes one and like,
right,
experiences his like, you know, anal sex capades, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Like, do you think, I mean, like, are the pills labeled or can you, like, did you opt, like, can you like not include this memory of me having sex with this guy?
Yeah, they're not even labeled. She has to like investigate what these pills are and like, what even any, are they anything? And then she has to like, rashly take them, and this is his master plan. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. We do the question of, you know, did Will really kill Judd is answered. I mean, because he did tell her, you know, I'm the one that strung your chief of police up, and she doesn't believe him because he's 90 and he can't get out of his wheelchair. But he wasn't lying to her. I mean, he was the one that did that. He, you know, so
yeah, and we learn how, and yeah, so that does makes sense.
Mm-hmm. We learn that masked vigilantism sort of runs in Angela's family, you know, so there's that. We learn a little bit more about, you know, the racist history of, you know, not just Tulsa. Clearly there was some racism in the police force in New York as well. So, yeah. A lot of this is clearly just set up for the next episode and a way to bring Angela and Will together and give them some sort of weird common ground that they can, you know, maybe build a relationship on. I have a question, and I don't want to lead this too much, but in the last episode, or one of the last episodes, Will and Lady True are sitting in her vivarium and they're talking, and Lady True says, I think you're being too cutesy with these pills. Why don't you know, you just talk to your daughter or whatever? And Will responds, oh, well, isn't that the same thing you're doing with your daughter? So now that we know a little bit more about these pills, do you have any idea what's going on with Bien and True? And if you, I don't expect you to, because it's not laid out, but now that we know that what at least the pills are for, you know, that could elaborate a little bit more of what maybe Lady True is trying to do. Because remember, we saw Bien wake up from that nightmare, and didn't she have an IV? I'm trying to remember. And so
there was some weird medical stuff going on there, I think. But yeah, okay, maybe.
You know, actually, that's a good point. I didn't think about that. Maybe that IV was nostalgia. Interesting. Okay.
Well, I didn't say that, but okay.
I didn't. I honestly don't know. I know what Bien, you know, what the character turns out to be, but it just, you know, I remember thinking it was weird. Like, you know, here's Bien sleeping overnight and she has an IV in her arm. Like, that's not a normal thing people do, right?
Right.
So clearly there's, you know, some weird relationship going on between True and Bien, and at least Will thinks that it's something sort of kind of similar to what's going on with, you know, Will and his daughter.
Bien is not a character that I care that much or really remember much of, so it's, I don't know. Okay. I guess I haven't put much thought into that, but
the only I know where it goes, and it becomes a much bigger thing, so you get a lot more Lady True and Bien, and then yes, so
okay,
we shall see. Any other questions get crossed off your list?
Probably
wasn't a whole lot more in this episode.
No, I mean, this is all focused on Will's backstory. Yeah. So, you know, most of the questions about Will, you know, is he a time traveler? I mean, we still don't know why he's impervious to heat. but we do know why he, you know, what does he have to
do with that's Judd's a good death. Question.
And we know what the pills are for. So, yeah, most of the stuff around the old man in the wheelchair, Will, was answered, but that's about it. I mean, this was a very contained episode. There wasn't even the section at the end with Adrian Veidt, right? Which we normally get.
Yes. Well, I don't know if you did. I don't know if you watched the preview for the next episode, but that's one of the things that comes up in the next episode is the, in essence, the trial of Adrian Veidt. So that's coming too. Yes, we get a big reveal on what's happening with him because the game warden was not happy with him. And yeah,
how many episodes are there left?
There are three more episodes.
Okay, 7, 8, 9. Okay.
How are you feeling about the show at this point? Because right about now, I think was when I was watching it the first time is when I started to panic because there were so many plot threads and so many unanswered questions. How many questions are still on your list? I mean, right?
A lot. Yeah. I have like, you know, like maybe a page and a half of just questions.
I think I had, you know, probably, you know, that many in my head going into loving this show and going, oh crap, there is only three episodes left. There is no way they're going to end this season on a cliffhanger and I'm going to be ticked because we're not going to know what happens to XYZ. This is right about the point. I think I started to panic.
I don't know if I'm as panicked. I do know that we are getting lots of crazy like new elements, and this episode really was just like, hey, like kind of a laugh in our face, like haha, we're gonna go on this entirely other tangent, another time period, and we're not gonna even address the present day much at all. But I do think that this show is providing some pretty good answers for some major points, you know, for me. The thing that I'm most worried about, I guess, at this point is, like, what is the overall message? What is the overall, like, thing that they're trying to say? I still don't really get it. I usually like to get that, like, kind of early on, and so that I can watch it. As I'm watching, I can say, oh, that really supports their point. But, like, I can't do that yet. So that's mostly where my concern is, but... Yeah, I do have a long list of questions, and this episode didn't help very much. So we'll see.
Right, that's what I remember thinking. Like, yeah. I have this list of questions, and then you get an entire episode, and it answers, you know, one, who is Will, and you're like, oh crap, there's so much left. There's no way they're going to get to it.
So many characters. I think Angela is the main character, obviously, and it's the one you're supposed to identify with. But there's a lot of characters in the show that. You kind of come in and out of their perspective. Like the last episode was all about Wade.
Happens to Wade. Cause I mean, last we saw Wade, the 7th Cavalry was marching into his house to beat the crap out of him. Right.
Yeah. And then you're telling me there's another one all about Bien. I'm like, okay.
I don't know if it's all about Bien, but there's definitely the last Lady True and Bien and the Millennium Clock and the 7th Cavalry. That's where we're going, right?
Okay. There's a lot. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on, but I'm down to keep going. So let's do it.
I'm digging it. I love the show. The more I watch this, the more I love the way he tells stories. So sign me up. All right. Well, that was all I have. The next episode, I'm just looking at it. Yeah, it's some Lady True stuff. So I'm looking forward to it. You know what? The other thing I'm curious if you have a prediction because we are 6 episodes into a 9 episode, not season, but series. So the entire thing is told in 9 episodes and you have now seen whatever 66% of it. And the biggest mystery I think of all is what's going on with Dr. Manhattan. Is he going to make an appearance? He's the biggest character in this universe. Can they get away with doing a show that does not have him? Can you have a Batman movie with no Batman, where all your Batman is off screen? So do you have a prediction at this point of what's up with Dr. Manhattan? Do we see Dr. Manhattan? Does he have a part in this story or not? I guess a better question is, does it matter?
Well, I think before you answered that, or before you just asked that question, I would say, like, no, and I don't really care that much, because I don't see, I don't see him being a super important character throughout this series so far, right? I mean, there's the phone booth with Laurie, who's kind of communicating with him. But it also, it just feels like it's her past. Her character doesn't really need Manhattan to be involved in her present. It's much of her past. Adrian Veidt has a lot. There's a lot going on there with it, like the play about Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
But that also feels very much in the past. And it doesn't really seem to be like it, there doesn't seem to be any plot elements that require Manhattan to be involved in that I see. So no, I guess I wouldn't expect it, and I wouldn't really care at this point.
Okay.
But Dr. Manhattan, but yeah, again, I'm not like a super fan of the comics, and I guess I don't understand how important Dr. Manhattan is to this like mythology. Which,
fair enough.
I can respect that, and I think that may be the case. So
he's had a very muted presence in this. Like you said, it's been the phone booth, you know, and you know, maybe the toy that Topher was playing with that sort of looked like his castle on Mars. You know, there's hints of Dr. Manhattan in this universe, but again, I think no one has seen him in 30 years. They think he's on Mars. They don't know what's going on with him. You know, there's very much the sense that, hey, we may not get a resolution to this story, and the only realistic resolution in the time period would be if, you know, there's a Deus Ex Machina at the end where Dr. Manhattan shows up and snaps his fingers and solves everybody's problems. So I'm just curious if that's something that you see coming, or I don't want to lead you on, because I don't want to say too much, but I'm just curious. It sounds to me like you're not concerned about it, and that's totally fine. That's totally valid. Ultimately, I think the question is can you have a Watchmen story without Dr. Manhattan, and is that okay? Can you tell a superhero story without your main character or one of your main characters? And I think the answer is yes, because I think, you know, we're 60% of the way through the show and we haven't seen any Dr. Manhattan. We've seen hints of Night Owl. We know he's in prison. You know, we've seen Laurie. We've seen, you know, a couple other characters. But really, this mm-hmm. is about the Watchmen, essentially, you know, I guess the police force is the Minutemen of this universe. And this is their story. And maybe we don't need a Dr. Manhattan. But
yeah, and we even have this other MacGuffin thing, this blinking flashlight that can be our Deus Ex Machina thing, too. So we don't even need that.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, all of those are totally valid. I'm just trying to see if, you know, someone from the outside who doesn't have the experience differently.
If he does enter the show, which you're very making me think that he does now, they've done a really good job of not indicating that.
Yes.
In the show. I'll say that.
Yeah. It's not like he's, you know, flying towards Earth and at the end of every episode they cut to him and it's like, oh, he's 1 hour away now. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like
right. mm-hmm.
there's no Chekhov's gun of
there's literally of Dr. no Manhattan. Interaction of Dr. Manhattan
right.
with any of the characters. If there is any, it's because they're reflecting on their far distant past.
Right.
Like Laurie and like Adrian Veidt, they're kind of Dr. Manhattan is in the past, and that's the only reference we really see, I think. So yes, there's no threads that indicate to me that he's coming back, but I guess we'll see. Yeah.
All right. Time will tell. Okay. That's all I got. And it's now 10 o'clock. So I'm going to go crash because I got to get up and take my kids to school early tomorrow in the morning.
Okay.
Signing off. See you later.
All right. Good night.